Good morning. Welcome to Encounter Church. I was smiling because I was like, if that had been played this weekend, people would have died. Those water balloons would have been seriously dangerous. Because I don't know about you, but like I decided any notion of dream of ever visiting the Arctic was completely out the window for me now that the Arctic had visited me. So, but I was like, oh my goodness, that would have been horrible this weekend. People really would have lost things that wouldn't have grown back. So anyways, I'm so glad that you are here today. My name is Chris Causey. I'm the lead pastor. And really, I think you're kind of coming into this church in the midst of kind of an exciting season, a central prayer for us. This kind of in the first 5-6 months of this year is that in this year we would experience a happy new year. Not say it, but experience it. And in some ways, it's February, and we kind of almost forget that, like, last month, we started making some choices. We decided we wanted to see some change. And it was kind of my prayer for this year that, man, like, let's say that we start to, as a church and as individuals, experience a happy new year. And that one of the challenges in moving into and moving towards better is oftentimes knowing where to start. That about only 7% of the global population is thriving in every major life domain based on kind of historical data. And so the reality is that most of us in this room are not knocking it out of the park in every area of our life. There's a few areas where we're probably frustratingly behind where we want to be. And so we've been working all last month. It took a whole lot longer than we ever anticipated and ended up becoming math and algorithms and all kinds of insanity. But we finally completed it. And it was a tool that we were working on to give you a snapshot of your life across the major life domains. And this idea of, like, how do we make happy happen in your life? And how do we help you make happy happen in your life? And so this is a beta test. So I'm going to give you that disclaimer. But we're really, really excited about just what we've been able to produce and where we've gotten it to, because 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was not sure we were going to get this thing figured out. So www.ahappy.me is how you can take this assessment. It's about a 5-minute long assessment, and as you're taking it, the algorithm is going to get smarter, and the results are going to get tweaked a little bit better. And you'll see it. So we're super excited we can finally roll that out. And this will live here. This is designed not for a happy new year assessment, but just in the course of everyday life, if you're kind of at a place where you feel stuck, that you can pull this out, go to this website in 5 minutes, kind of see where you can get started to move towards better. And part of this year, really kind of through all the series, is building out of this. And one of the elements and areas that I'm working on getting better in my life, that I'm just coming out of the pandemic, I saw God answer so many prayers that I want to help some of us grow in that, is this thing we're going to be starting. I'm going to do once a month, and it's probably not going to be for everyone because it'll be a different style teaching. I'm going to teach on prayer, and then we're going to pray, and we're going to take communion. So it's going to be a little bit more of an intimate, in-depth dive. But if you are not getting our emails, I'm going to be sending out a link to that for this once a month, the date, the time. And so encounterchurch.com/email, that link will send you to our email page where you can sign up. So a lot of exciting things happen that I want you to be a part of, and this is one of them, prayer and communion once a month with me. All right, so today we're going to kick off this series called Let the Games Begin. And Dallas and I are actually going to tag team this through, double team it, I guess you could say, to keep with the theme, that we're going to kind of handle this series through the month of February. And I think this has the power to be like really transformative for you and for me. In some ways, it reminds me when I was working on this of a period right after Jenny and I, my wife, had gotten married. And we had lived the first year while we were both in grad school in a small little apartment that was like a little bit bigger than a closet. And I remember, like, Jenny getting a job as a school teacher. And so, like, she's now officially, like, my sugar mama. And I am still in grad school. And I'm, like, feeling good because I have a sugar mama, which was the definition of success for me at that point in life. And so we, like the Jeffersons, we just moved on up. Like, I mean, we don't have to live in a closet anymore. We don't have to be Harry Potter underneath a stairwell. Like, we can do this thing. And so we get a bigger apartment that's almost, like, twice the size, and it has a fireplace, and it's got a balcony, and it's like, man, this is amazing. And there's no college students partying till like 4 a.m. underneath us and beside us, and we're like, this is awesome. And so we're getting settled, but we're like newlyweds, and so we're still in that stage where she's a sugar mama, but we don't have that much money. So most of our furniture, appliances are borrowed. People have given it to us, you know how that goes. And so we're packing for a trip, hanging out with a friend, and like in this moment, you've ever had that moment where you like your ear like and your brain suddenly sync up and you're like, the bathtub's been running for a while, right? You ever had that moment? I had that moment sitting talking to my friend with, because I had the washing machine running because we were going on this trip, and so we were trying to get all our clothes washed for it. And at that point in our marriage, like, we didn't have clothes that goes beyond like a week. So it's like, if you were going on a week trip, you had to wash this week's, you know. And so, like, we're trying to get everything, and I'm like, wait a second, the washing machine's been running for a while. And I go around the corner, and our floor is like standing in water. And about the time that happens, and I'm like, oh my goodness, we've just flooded it, I'm about to say, because we're on the top floor, out of my mouth, bam, 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 our front door. And so Jenny opens it, and it's our neighbor, who we were just meeting for the first time, who lives underneath us. And he's like, there is water all in my apartment. And in my head, I'm thinking, like, we just did this to this guy's apartment, right? And I'm like, oh my goodness, we just flooded a guy's apartment. And this is the first time I'm like, hey, my name is Chris, nice to meet you, neighbor. And so he was like, you need to come downstairs with me. Which at the time, like, I was like, yeah, I should come downstairs with you, because why not, right? In retrospect, probably not the best idea to go visit a person you don't know who you just flooded their house. But I was like, sure, let's go down there. And so when we actually get down there, what I find is, like, there are, like, these puddles in the paint, and it's all puddling down the wall, and it's gotten into their floor, and we have to call the, like, home, like, office up front, and they bring in their, like, huge fans, and they're trying to dry it and clean it, and we're still trying to pack for our trip the next morning. And I'm like, I am so, so sorry. Like, I've never flooded an apartment before. This is my first time, and please forgive me. I'm like, what do you buy someone who you flooded their apartment? Is, like, a towel an appropriate house drying gift? Like, what do you do? And he was so mad. So, like, we come back from the trip, and we figured out, okay, the cheap washing machine that a family member had donated to us, it's broken. If you put it on the large setting, it doesn't stop. So we only started washing the medium setting. And then we were talking, and again, my brain does the thing. It's like, wait a second. Jenny, that's been running for a long time. This is like a week after. I go around the corner, the floor is flooded, and again, bam, 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 and I open up the door, and I'm just like, I am so sorry. Like, it's flooded again, isn't it? He was like, I was like, you know, like, he moved out within a few days, and I've never seen him again. I'm so grateful, because, like, the first time, it's like, man, that's the washing machine's bad. The second time, that's like, that's clearly on me. I'm going to take that. And so, like, that day, we like, threw the thing out and went and bought a new washing machine. It was the first appliance as a couple we ever bought. And the reason that that story came to mind out of nowhere was, in some ways, this series and what we're leaning into this month, I think, has that same effect. That when this one area of our life has the power to just spill over into every area of our lives. How we manage this area, how we navigate this area, how we live and play this game in this area, will determine in so many ways the quality and the outcome of our lives. And it's the area of relationships. That what happens in our relationships do not stay in our relationships, they spill over. They spill over in our overall quality of life. They spill over into other relationships. What happened to you growing up, what you experienced in previous relationships, spill over into the next ones. And unless we get a handle on this thing, unless we really lean in intentionally and begin to recognize maybe there's some things to learn about relationships, we're just going to keep doing and keep flooding the way that we did with that washing machine. And fortunately for us, God is a relational God. Relationship is at the core of the Christian faith. In fact, the very idea of salvation or of rescue, redemption, is inherently relational. God cares about relationships. He's a relational God. And so when Christianity is unfolding and one of its chief messengers named Paul begins to spread the Christian faith to other circles where there was no foundation at all. There was no Judaism. Because Christianity was really at the outer working theologically of just Judaism fulfilled. Like the promises, the promised one of Judaism became the person of Christ in Christianity. So they're not two separate things. It was the fulfillment of Judaism. So if you grew up in a Jewish context, you had so much of the foundation of what would become the Christian faith. And so Paul is the first person who goes beyond kind of the Jewish circles where people had a little bit of the backdrop of where the Christian faith emerged from. And so Paul is now going into these cultures that are completely kind of foreign to the Jewish or what we now call the Judeo-Christian worldview. And so he's bumping up against people who are trying to live out this new Christian faith they've found, but they're doing it in the way that they've always done life. And it's kind of sort of creating some tension in the church. And one letter specifically, one church specifically, where there was a lot of drama, like Maury Povich, Jerry Springer level drama, was the church in Corinth. It was a church that, in the midst of this influential, very wealthy, affluent area, these people had excitedly found Jesus and had become Christians and were really sideways in their relationships. And that sidewaysness continued to kind of spill over into the church. And it really did kind of get to that Jerry Springer level thing. And so Paul writes a series of letters, multiple letters to this church to get them under kind of this new teaching. It's like, I want to teach you how to live out the Christian faith. And so he sends them a passage. He sends them a letter that I want to read from today, this portion of it. And most likely you've seen this before. I've taught on this passage before. It's a powerful passage. But for most of us, if we've ever encountered this passage, it's been in the context of marriage and a wedding ceremony. And one of the first things I want to go ahead and disconnect from you, your brain, in this passage is that this was not written for a marriage ceremony. This was written regarding relationships in general within the church. I would argue that marriage actually is a heightened form of even this passage. So it's a further elevation. But it's found in 1 Corinthians 13. And what's fascinating is long before foreigner ever asked the question, like Paul had already addressed it. And that's what we're going to look at. And that's a vague reference to foreigner. I want to know what love is. Right? And this is exactly kind of at the core of, because Paul's thing is like, love is the rule of relationship. And everyone thinks they know what love is. And that's why foreigner was like, I don't know if I know what love is. I want to know. And so Paul starts with this. He says, love is patient. Love is kind. It is not envy. It is not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrong. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. And that's such a high standard. It's such an amazing, compelling picture that it's no surprise that this shows up in marriage ceremonies, because it's beautiful. But what's subtle that's really important is Paul is answering the question of like, hey, the core of Christian relationships, the core in how we do relationships, the rule book, right? Because we all, if you're asked to play a game, the first question you're going to ask with a game you've never played is, what are the rules? How do I play it? And Paul is saying, hey, look, you fundamentally have a bad set of rules to relationship. So I'm going to give you a new rule book that tells you. But I'm not even going to assume that you even know what the word love means. Because you've inserted your own definition, church. And so he gives us this incredible section. And because it's in English, we can miss the nuance of what's actually playing out. When he writes this, he's writing this letter originally in an ancient form of Greek. And so what actually is present in this is 15 verbs. A little harder to see that if you're just kind of reading through in the English. But there are 15 different verbs, 7 positive, 8 negative, that are addressing and answering the question of what love is and what is the rule book for relationships. The first, the very beginning point is love is patient, which I think is actually an interesting choice. When Paul begins to define what love is, he chooses to start with the word patient. Now, I think for many of us, like, we think patience is a secondary thing, like it's something that we all know we need to work on. We're usually reminded of that when we're stuck in a line or we're stuck in traffic or we're waiting on something to download and we've got somewhere to be or we're ready to leave somewhere and somebody in our group is talking still to someone else, right? Like that is oftentimes when we identify patience as a need. But Paul is saying, no, like in relationships, love's first manifestation is often in patience. Now, you have to realize that Paul is writing as one of the most premier Jewish scholars in the world prior to becoming a Christian. So when he uses the word patience, the Hebrews had an incredibly deep, rich meaning for the word patience that wasn't present in the Greek world or the Roman world that now Paul is in. And so there was an element of this word is really heavily weighted. In fact, I was reminded of this, kind of the, almost the differences, even this week. So it's not an ancient kind of like, oh, the Romans and the Jews, and they had different definitions. Actually, like it played out this week when I went to my dentist appointment on Wednesday. I arrived at 9 a.m. I'd been having some dental work done, and I walk in, and my dentist is like, hey, do you have a little bit of time? Like, your appointment today is like 9 to 10, but could you be flexible with us? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I've got a lunch appointment, but yeah, sure, I can be flexible. And she's like, okay, we're gonna really try to, like, fix some of the issues that we've been dealing with this. I just had a root canal, and so they're, like, wanting to repair this tooth and get this thing figured out. And she was like, you're going to have to, you know, like, I've got to figure it out, but if you're willing to be a little patient with me and wait, extend your thing, then we're good. So they move me to a different room in the very back of the building, and they begin to work. So 9 turns into 10, and 10 turns into 11, and 11 turns into 12. I'm having to text the person I'm supposed to have lunch with, because at this point, they've, like, pulled things and pulled on things, and I can't eat. I mean, there's like no way I'm going to be able to eat at this point. And so I'm like, hey, I can't make it. I'm so sorry. My wife at this point is beginning to text me like, why are you still at the dentist? And sending me memes like, I hope you're paying rent. And like, you're a squatter. I mean, like, so she's kind of harassing me via text message. But at this point, my rear end had been in that dental chair from 9 to lunchtime. And I'm starting to realize that like you can develop like butt sores from sitting in a dental chair because those things aren't very plush. They're not lush. They're not recliners. They may recline, but they are not recliner. And I'm like, man, I'm kind of doing the butt wiggle dance because it's getting uncomfortable. And, you know, and now at this point, like people are taking breaks and like going on lunch breaks, and like one of the guy comes from up front, and he was like, "Oh man, I'm so glad. Thank you for being patient." And he was like, "Oh, I guess this is why they call it patience, And then he walks off to go on his lunch break, I'm sure. And I'm just sitting there, and 12 turns into 1, and it turns into 2, turns into 3, turns into 4, and it turns into 4:45. I never get anything to drink, never get anything to eat. My mouth is still sore from the root canal I had less than 48 hours before. And they decide around noon that they need to do gum surgery on me. So then we move into gum surgery. My mouth is so sore from the root canal. And so at that point, they begin to give me shots to numb it so that they can do more work. And I sit in the chair so long, waiting on, because they're like, keep bouncing in and out for their breaks and all the things they've got going on, that the medicine wears off and they have to numb me again. I get 12 shots from around 11:30 to 4:30. My wife is like, seriously, are you coming home? Like, what is happening? And I'm like, I don't even know. And then I go to check out, and they're like, he was like, man, you were so patient today. And I was like, yeah, my wife kept saying, are you paying rent? And he was like, sort of. And I was like, what does that mean? And then he leans over and he's like, it's 3-1-2-5-7. I'm like, oh, okay, that's pretty great. 6. I was like, well, hold up, man. Did you just say $3,000? He's like, yes, $3,000. And I'm like, so I like walk out of that, like, just completely dejected, right? But I was thinking about how he kept calling me patient. And his idea was very much similar to the Greeks, that it's just, it's a waiting. It's just a kind of standing, sitting, just waiting for it to be finished. But what he didn't know was the actual situation was the picture of patience in the Jewish Christian frame. You see, when Paul uses this word, it's synonymous with this. When you say you're patient, it means you are long-suffering. It's not short-suffering. It's not just a little jab. It's 12 shots all day in a chair, and you're stuck there. It's long-suffering. And the Hebrew kind of word for this, word for patient, was really fascinating because it was a word picture of a long nose, because God would keep, the idea that God could keep breathing in and keep putting up with us when so many others would have just let it out and be like, okay, I'm done. Like, we all have those people where it's like the moment you keep building in, you keep building in, keep building in, and then you reach your breaking point. And the idea of God was that he had a long nose because he never reached his breaking point. He just kept breathing in. He had an ability to long suffer. And Paul, in his leading word to describe the rules of relationship, is that we should be long suffering. And the reason why is because while all relationships have those moments, right, when she walked down the aisle and she was beautiful, or when you were first handed your child and they're in your arms, or like the moments with your parents and it was funny and you're laughing, or your best friend and you're having like the day of your life. But there's not all fun and games. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes that child that was put in your arms will not allow you to sleep. And you think, finally, I made it through the hard times. They can sleep now, without me being there. And then they turn into teenagers. And you would pay money to put them in a time machine to get back the babies, because they were easier then. Right? And because to love is to suffer. And to love well is to long suffer. And in case you're tempted to like poke the person beside you because you're like, you need to be more patient with me, they need to poke you back and be like, well, can you quit causing me to suffer so much? Like, could you dial it down and I'll dial mine up and we'll be in a perfect happy place? But But I think Paul is leading out with like, hey, realistically, let's talk about what love looks like and let's talk about what relationships look like. It's hard. And it's not always good. But isn't this like the picture that you, where love really stands out? When someone keeps giving you patience, even though you know they shouldn't? Or how they stay calm? Like, you get a deeper picture. You get a divine picture of love. Because up until this period, the word patience and the way that Paul is using it had never been applied to human beings. It always had been applied to God. But he's like, you're Christians. You're walking with the Spirit of God inside of you. This is to be the mark of how you love. You long suffer. And then he goes from patient to kind. And kind is a word that has lost some of its teeth. It's in some ways culturally, it's synonymous with niceness. But like, kindness is not niceness. Nice is like holding your tongue, smiling when you maybe could have said something mean. We'll give the nice label to people, and when in reality, we have no clue what the composition of their character is. It's like, oh, the customer, he comes in every single day, and he's always smiling. He's so nice. It's like, the dude, I mean, have you not listened to any of these serial podcasts? Like, that dude might be like, he might have a torture chamber in his basement. You don't know if nice means good. Right? When Paul uses the word kind, there is a heaviness to it. We hear nice and we're like, man, they've got good intentions. They come in and they're smiling. But for Paul, it's like, no, this is not about good intentions. This is about intentional acts of good. Niceness is passive. Niceness doesn't require anything from you. Niceness just means you don't do anything bad. Kindness is defined by the acts of good that you do. It's active. There is no way to be kind and passive in a situation. You're not kind if you're being passive. And kindness has nothing to do with the other side. It has everything to do with you and your choice. So when we're kind, we're intentionally doing acts of good for them. They're the starting point and they're the finish line. What do they need from me? That's what I'm going to do for them. Even if they're not good to me. Even if they're not kind to me. I'm going to be kind. And the reason that Paul, I think, leads with patience and kindness is because at the very core of how God treated you and me was his patience and his kindness. He was patient with us in our toddler-like rebellious ways, and he was kind and good to us long before we ever, ever did anything good for him. He's like, look, we do this. This is the operating rule book of love because this was how we were loved. This is how we were guided and guarded. And I think, if you heard nothing else from this message, if you just started applying patience and kindness to your relationships, you would watch some of them transform. I've never, never sat down with a couple who was going through some tension and one of them look at me and say, you know what, I just don't think this is going to work. He is way too patient with me. She is way too kind to me. I can't. I'm bailing. I've never met a teenager who has a horrible relationship with their parents. And when I get into it, they're like, oh, it's the patience. It's undoing me. I can't take it here anymore. I've never met a coworker who's like, I'm quitting my job because my boss is the kindest person you've ever met and it's driving me insane. No. Because if we just lead with those two things, that's so counter to what people experience. It's so powerful. It's transformative. And Paul is calling us to reflect Jesus in our relationships because that's how Jesus loved us. patience and kindness. And there's no weak sentimentality with that. It's intense. It is a whole next level thing when you're good to people who are bad to you. But I'm telling you, some of my most, like, when I stand before God, some of my most proud moments are going to be the moments where I didn't punch somebody in the face and I blessed them. I did something good for them. Like, I almost hesitated in saying this because I was like, well, you might think I'm mad at you. But I was like, if you ever want to proportion, understand, like, where you, if you do something mean to me, like, and then you get something really nice from me, like, that's because I'm like, oh, I'm going to bless them. I'm going to bless them hard. You know, it's like, I'm going to be kind. Right? It's like, whew. Because, like, that's what Jesus did. So I'm like, okay, I got to double down on that. So I was like, man, Chris is so kind. It's like, you must have really, really upset him. That's not, but sometimes it is. I'm just saying, right? It's like, here you go. I got this for you. No other reason outside you a horrible person, right? Because it's patience and kindness is to be the mark. And that's the way we play love. That's the rule book. But what I appreciate about what Paul did is Paul understands for human beings. Like in 2009, there were four Vanderbilt University professors who put men in functional MRIs, I think was the specific machine, where it was like real-time brain analysis. And that what they wanted to do was see how men's brains responded to hearing advice from the wives on areas that the men did not want to get advice on. Okay, so they'd kind of schemed on this thing. They stick the men in the MRIs and they're like, hey, we have a recording we want you to listen to. And it's the wife talking about something that the husband doesn't want to hear about, giving him advice. And what they found with men's brains, with that being played, was it didn't activate the part of the brain that normally activates when someone's giving you feedback. Because we have that part of our brain that when you're being told by a coach to do this differently, and it's like, beep, 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 boop, boop, boop. You know, okay, computing, do that differently. Now, what they found with the men's brains, well, what was activating was suspicion and distrust. It was the part that was conveying to the researchers that they were questioning the motives of the speaker, not evaluating the methods of what they were doing. They weren't getting feedback. They were getting frustrated. And like this kind of basically confirmed what pretty much every woman already knows since like the dawn of time, right? That husbands don't listen to their advice. And now like science backs it up, okay? So you're welcome. So all you got to do now is just whisper Vanderbilt University. And it's you've got it. You're like, you remember that? You don't want to be those guys. But it's like Paul's genius, and what he does next is he understands the default in our relationships. He understands what we tend to do, not what we're supposed to do, which is why he pivots from love is patient to love is kind to this section right here. And if you notice, it's like it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not dishonor, it is not self-seeking, it is not easy anger, it does not keep record of wrong, it does not delight in evil. He moves from the two positives to a whole section of negatives. Because he's wanting us to understand, look, if we're fully going to develop what love looks like in our life, we also need to look at the negative. So I'm in high school, it's predated myself, but like in high school, I took a photography class. And back then, when you took a picture, it wasn't digital, it wasn't on a phone, right? It was in a little tiny film, and you would go into a little room, a dark room, and you would mix all these smelly chemicals together, and you would produce a negative. And I remember seeing a negative for the first time, and I'm like, that's not the picture. And it's like, it is the picture. It's just the negative of the picture. And then you go to the next machine, and you slide the negatives in, and through the magic of chemistry, a picture appears out of the negative. And this is exactly what Paul's doing. He's like, look, your default is the negative to what I'm trying to teach you. The way we do relationships, envy, arrogance, pride, dishonoring, self-seeking, easily angered, record of wrongs, right? Where it's like you have a Rolodex and calendar in your head. You like 3 years ago, you know what you said to me? And we just keep it. Paul's like, this is not how love is meant to look. This is the negative. So let's develop this. And this is this really powerful, because this is pretty much the definition of a toxic relationship. Being in a relationship with someone who's arrogant, who doesn't listen, who's self-centered and selfish. Like, none of us would sign up for this kind of relationship willingly. And yet, all of us have these kind of relationships in our lives, because that's the default. That's how people act. Broken people do broken things. Hurting people hurt people. And I think the genius of Paul is to recognize, like, hey, church, I know this is how you did relationships before, but I want to remind you how I started. He's how we do relationships now. And as he's walking through this kind of toxic mix to say this is what we don't do, there is this interesting phrase embedded in it that I think is really important, because I don't have time to walk through 15 verbs. So this is like the last verb I want to give you. Because I actually think this one's really powerful. And this goes beyond just being raised in a house where, like, respect was a really big deal. Like, I grew up in one of those homes. My mom, phenomenal woman. And it was like, yes, sir. No, ma'am. Like, you use those words. And then I moved into adulthood, and I would offend people when I'd say it, because they would be like, well, I'm not 75. Why'd you just say yes, sir, to me? I'm just 2 years older than you. And I'm like, but you're my boss. Like, I'm told I'm supposed to respect you. And, like, please don't hate me. But, like, it was just so ingrained in me. But this goes beyond respect. In fact, right after we got married that season, you know, when you kind of, like, you're engaged and you've got the wedding shower and you go into the store and you're like, oh, man, we get to build our wedding registry. And so, like, I had no clue. So my wife and I are walking through the store and we're, like, scanning things left and right. We're like, oh, yeah, we need a sword of Excalibur, like, butter knife, chink, chink, you know. And, like, we need fine china because we're going to eat on it every single day, beep, beep, you know. And it's like we're just scanning all of these things. And then crazy people bought them for us. And so we're at home and we're unboxing it when we get back from our honeymoon. And I'm like, shing. I'm like, why do we need a butter knife like this again? And why is all our utensils silver? And why is our glass look like it was created by elves from Lord of the Rings? Like, do we really need this stuff? Because I'm afraid to use our silverware and our, like, our plates. Like, it's like pressure. And so we're like, okay, you know, we should probably exchange this for some, like, practical things like sheets and, like, real forks that we're not going to use when we're hosting the queen. And so, like, we go and we're, and so I'm at one of the stores where we'd registered, and I'm waiting in line with some of this stuff. And this older gentleman walks up behind me. And he's standing there. It's a pretty long line. My wife walks up, and she's like, hey, I'm going to go shop for the replacement items while you're waiting. So maybe, like, we'll time it. So when you're up there, I'll have the items. And I'm like, great. Go team Causey, right? So she walks off, and he's like, newlyweds, huh? And I'm like, yeah, actually. Like, it's awesome. Yeah, we're exchanging out. And he's like, And I was like, oh. I'm like, are you married? He's like, yeah, I'm married to an old bat. And I was like, oh, okay. What does that even mean, man? He's never met me before. And for the next 15 minutes while we're waiting in line, he's just, like, railing on his wife. And, you know, you enjoy it while you can, because they don't stay that way. He's like, I remember we were that way. It ain't that way now. And, like, he's just mean thing after mean thing. And in my head, I'm like, dude, you wouldn't dare say this to that woman's face, would you? Like, you're probably a coward. And I kept, like, secretly hoping she'd walk up behind him. She'd be like, oh, bat, huh? Whap, you know, and just, like, hit him in the head. And, like, I just got so disgusted. Like, by the end of it, I just had to kind of say, like, hey, man, it seems like your marriage isn't what you hoped it was going to be. But can I kind of politely say, like, there's only two people responsible for the relationship that my wife and I are going to be, that we're going to have, and you're not one of them. We get to determine that. So with all due respect to you and your wife, can you please stop talking about your wife like that? I was like, dude, you're disgusting me. And you're so much older, and I shouldn't be saying this to you. But I've got this problem. Like, when I was at the dentist, I'd been there from 9 a.m. to 4:30. Around 3, I'd started kind of keeping mental track of all the inefficiencies in their systems and their processes and, like, the way they did things. And I'd started computing how many more patients they could add to their calendar in a day if they just changed some things I watched them do. And so right before the final procedure, I said, hey, I've noticed some inefficiencies that I would love to share with you. I think it could help you make a lot more money and even see more patients. And she was like, let's get started, and, like, pulls open my mouth, you know. So it's been a problem my entire life of probably saying things I shouldn't say. But I say to that man, but I left because that moment was such a crystallized moment for me that I was like, I never want to be that old dude. I never want to be married in that kind of relationship. And so I left that day, like, resolved with this negative of trying to figure out what the positive looks like. And I mean, it was, there's only been a few things where it's like I made a holy promise, but this is one of them. It's like, I am never, ever going to be caught in a conversation, in writing, in speech, in a message, period, private or public, where someone ever hears me dishonor my wife, where someone ever hears me dishonor my children. When I share stories about my kids in the midst of a message, I always literally am thinking about 30 years from now when they're listening back to the message. And do they hear in my words, even if it's funny, that I love them? That I'm for them. It became this thing. To the point that even when I was dealing with some rough relational things that were playing out a few years ago, and I was talking to my mentor, and he knew I was pressing with, he was like, why won't you talk about this with me? Why? And I'm like, I'm not throwing them under the bus. And I was like, that their worst moments towards me is not the defining element of who they are completely. And I'm like, I'm just not going to do that. And it was rooted in this. And before you think this is some kind of, like, distorted medieval chivalry merged into Christianity, I think the genius of this thing is it gets to the core of what it means to be a Christian. When you understand that God, in his patience and his kindness, pursued us, chased after us, to redeem us, to restore us, and the way he chose to do that, the way he had to do that, was to die on a cross. It meant that my purchase price was his death. The death of God on a cross is my price tag. And I think honor, very simply, is about treating people the way that reflects the price tag that all of them have. That no matter how mean, I'm not saying we don't have boundaries, but no matter how mean and vile you are, you still have a price tag hanging off of you that is of infinite worth and value. You've been stamped and made in the image of God. And I just think, man, there's something compelling about when you treat people like they have value and worth, it changes them. Like, I was talking to one of my mentors this week, and he was encouraging me in something. And the guy is, like, phenomenally gifted, New York best time selling author multiple times over, absurd successful. And he was commenting on something I'd sent to him. He was like, that was really good. I was like, you mean that? He was like, yeah, that was really, really good. And, like, the rest of the day, I kind of floated. I was like, oh, you know, because, like, someone pointed to my price tag and was like, hey, that's higher than you're treating it right now. And it lifted the value. And the most powerful, influential, most positive defining people in your life and in my life are the people who come into your life and hold up your price tag and see a different number than what you see or maybe what others have seen. And imagine if that was our rule book for relationships. Imagine how powerful that would be for people if we treated them that way. You see, Paul ends with this. He said, when I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child, and when I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. He was essentially saying very, very bluntly to the church, like, the way you've been loving is childish. The way you've been selfish, self-centered, all about you, like, that's what toddlers do. He's like, but if you're going to do relationships the way it was intended to be done, then it's time for you to grow up. Not selfish, but selfless. Not focused on you, but oriented towards them. That, he says, is how we play. That's the rule book for relationships, is love. A love that's patient, a love that's kind, a love that honors and seeks to recognize the value that every person on planet Earth has, and seeks to avoid all the negative things that used to define us that were underneath the bigger, broader umbrella of being childish. And this month, I'm so excited because next week we're going to come back and we're going to look at the playbook for how to do this tactically and practically in our relationships. I'm going to give you a really simple framework that I think has the power to instantly kind of assess where you are relationally in a way that you can action, take immediate action on it. So I get to kind of say, here's the rule book, here's the playbook, and then Dallas over the last 2 weeks of the month is going to help us unpack some of the games that we sometimes play that get in the way of the relationship that we're intended to have. But what I want you to hear today is that love manifested, defined by Jesus himself and the way that he acted towards us and long-suffered with us, is meant to be the rule book. And if that's the rule book, then we really can truly say of relationships to let the games begin. Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you for your kindness, your love. Thank you that what Paul writes did not originate in the minds of philosophers or poets. It was not born out of some romantic notion of sentimentality or just some ancient manuscript, but that this rule of relationships, this love, was anchored in heaven, was lived out on earth through you, Jesus. So may you help us today as we respond, as we move, as we look at our relationships, that we would in our own hearts choose to grow up in the way we love. To be committed to showing up with more patience, more kindness, less envy and less arrogance, less selfishness, and that people would see in us your love towards us and towards them. And thank you for the power of that love that brings breakthrough. And it's in your name, Jesus, I pray. Amen.